as one spends more time in meditation and seclusion, as we've had the chance to do for this rains retreat, then one of the things that becomes very apparent is the softness and the vulnerability of the mind. And even though the poster campaigns for Buddhism are all about happiness, and it's become very much the buzz thing of happiness conferences and happiness education and happiness psychology and so on and so forth. But perhaps this tendency to emphasize the happiness, although very necessary, perhaps this can also be taken too far. Because, of course, the reality is for most of us, we don't spend all of our time being happy. We spend a lot of time being sad. Sometimes anyway, not all the time, I don't want to be too cynical about this, but sometimes the more we show or display or put a veneer of happiness on, the more this is masking our own feelings. And we have to somehow pretend that we're happy. We feel that we have to pretend that we're happy. We're Buddhists, and Buddhists are supposed to be happy, aren't they? They can test it. You can stick Buddhist meditators in a big machine and it proves that they're happy. See? Those numbers go up there. Those little lights light up. That proves that the person's happy. Of course, the fact that the person feels happy has got nothing to do with it. It's where the lights light up in the little machine that tells you whether you're really happy or not. And so maybe that's if we feel, if we're monks and nuns, that somehow sometimes we feel like we're under an obligation to be happy. We're under an obligation to be together, to sort of have it kind of worked out and be emotionally competent and these kinds of things. And so there can easily be a split and a tension between where we're at and where we feel like we have to project, or what kind of face we have to present to the world. And it especially comes about in in my opinion, in I'm trying to put this in a non, in an ideologically correct and yet non-clumsy way. I was going to say Western monastics, but not just Western monastics, but monastics who are not from a traditional Buddhist background is probably the best way of putting it. Those people who've grown up in the traditional Buddhist countries, Thailand, and especially in Theravada countries, Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka and so on. They have plenty of time to see all through their lives the different facets of Buddhism and how it works and how monastic life works sometimes and doesn't work, and the good and bad qualities of that. And so they have if they retain and have a strong idealism about their practice, this is also tempered with a very down-to-earth understanding that this kind of idealism and aspiration is far from universal in the Buddhist world, and even or especially within the Buddhist monastic world. And you can see this very frequently in the writings of the forest tradition, Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Man or Ajahn Mahabua. And they'll always tell stories about about how you know, for example, one of Ajahn Mahabua's stories when he was a young monk in Bangkok studying, and he did 3 years in Bangkok doing his Dhamma degree as such. It's kind of like equivalent to a bachelor's degree. And you know, after he finished his lessons, he used to go and meditate. And he'd be sitting and walking meditation, and all the other monks used to make fun of him. Like, they used to laugh at him. "How's it going, Buddha? You found Nibbana yet? Tell us when you get there. Tell us when you get to Nibbana. Tell us whether it's real or not." And so he sort of wonders, what's happened to those monks now? I wonder where they've gone. And so it's a sad but very real fact that such attitudes are very common in Buddhism. And when we arrive, you know, without having the benefit of that kind of broader appreciation of how Buddhism works in a culture and a society, and then we tend to be very idealistic about what Buddhism is. We tend to project a lot. We reify a lot. We take ideas that we've read out of books about Buddhism, and we somehow imagine that they accurately and completely represent the real world of Buddhism. And of course we get disappointed. Or else we read books talking about different kinds of meditation, and the, you know, the course of meditation and the different kinds of stages of practice and things like that. And then we go off and we practice it, and we realize that it's not quite as difficult. Sorry, not quite as easy as we imagined. Sometimes maybe we find it's not quite as difficult as we imagined. Perhaps slightly rarer. But we find that it's not as easy as we imagined. And and so you find, you know, in my experience, in the kind of the young monks when they ordain, then they, you know, you hear them say kind of macho things, like they say, I'll never give a Dhamma talk until I get stream entry. These kinds of things, you know, and or you know, I'll never leave this monastery until I get fourth jhana or something like that, and. Of course, when you have this kind of attitude, it makes actually realizing those things almost impossible. And the actual realization of advanced states of samadhi and insight and so on don't come about through that kind of willful ambition, but they come about through a devotion to actually doing the practices that are really necessary here and now, not through kind of projecting yourself into an idealized future. And so we build up these kinds of ideas of what we are, what we should be doing, what Buddhism is, what it isn't, what's a good monastery, what's not a good monastery, what's a good teacher, what's not a good teacher, and blah, blah, blah. And we create all these fantasies in our mind. And the fantasies don't, the real world is sadly lacking, sadly deficient. And often we feel that very keenly within ourselves. And especially we feel that because usually those of us who've come from non-traditional Buddhist backgrounds, we need usually some fairly strong psychological push to actually get us into the monastery in the first place. Sometimes not. Some people just show up and maybe it's past life associations or something like that. Who knows? But for most of us, and I think we've all seen that since we've been here, that most of the people who tend to come to the monastery have do so because they suffer. Certainly that's the case for myself. And it's difficult to think of somebody who is not like that. We've all suffered for some reason or other, and this is why we've ended up here. And so we should take it for granted that in some sense that sadness is there. And we shouldn't kind of marginalize that or just trivialize it. It's actually quite central. It's central to what we're doing and how we're living here. Remember in the Chula Vedala Sutta we just recited, it talks about the counterpart, like what's the counterpart of pleasant feeling is painful feeling, what's the counterpart of painful feeling is pleasant feeling. And so in some sense the depth of sadness that we can experience is stretches the spectrum of what we can experience, the spectrum of our consciousness, and the deeper the sadness, not necessarily the most intense of sadness, but the deeper the sadness, then the deeper the happiness that we also will feel. And the converse also applies, so the deeper the happiness we experience, if we experience very profound happiness and joy in our meditation at some times, then that can very easily turn over. This is like a shift of the attention, or just with the kind of, you know, subconscious evocation of some kind of memory or association or past life thing or whatever. And then this very deep sadness can come out of a sense of very deep joy, and you can have that very deep sadness. And so these kinds of deeply felt emotions, you know, if you experience them in your meditation, then you see how much more real and more meaningful these things are than those ideas and fantasies which we've constructed about quote-unquote Buddhism, Buddhist practice, Buddhist meditation, and so on and so forth. So like on the one hand we have our ideas about what the path is, and you know, we go through these stages and we do these practices and so on. And then there's the actual reality of experiencing these things. the reality of experiencing them. So the more we, in some senses, the more we insist on and reify these ideas about practice, which could be anything, that could come from any perspective. It could be a meditation technique, it could be a you know, idea or philosophy about the Dhamma, it could be a particular, you know, whatever. It could be anything, but just so we have some kind of idea in our mind. Now, the more we insist upon that idea, see, ideally, if practice goes according to the way that the texts present it, then these things unify themselves. So we have this idea, for example, of the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, where we are now, we can't maybe experience every factor of that Eightfold Path, and so we have that kind of suffering that it's spoken about again in the Chula Vedala Sutta, where it speaks, oh, when shall I experience those realms which the noble ones enter and abide in? And so we experience sadness because of this, okay? But that's a wholesome sadness, a sadness that abandons the tendency towards aversion. So we may have that kind of sadness, but it's like a wholesome sadness. And as our practice goes on, we can more and more and more unify or fit in our own experience with our ideas about what the Noble Eightfold Path is. So there's a movement from from a split or a duality in our consciousness towards unity, where the actual reality we're experiencing is the same as the reality described in the texts. Okay? That's the ideal. Okay, and given that Buddhist teachings are in fact described very beautifully and that they do relate to our awareness in a very lovely way, then it's very common that that actually happens. So it's very common that that ideal way that things proceed actually is true to a greater or lesser extent. And I think we've probably all seen in some ways that idea that we can in some sense have a longing or wish to aspire to a particular aspect of the Dhamma or practice, and then later on we can actually reach that and we actually feel that sense of satisfaction because of that. So that's very nice. But of course, it's not always like that. And for most of us, as long as we're not yet arahants, then there's still some feeling of separation between our ideal of where we want to be and the reality of where we're actually at. And for most of us, for most of our time of practice, that's where we're spending our time, is in that ambiguous area where we're neither completely devoid of practice nor are we completely unified and attained to everything that we wish to attain to. That's where most of us spend our life, somewhere in that kind of twilight zone. So we've got to get used to it. We have to be used to living in that twilight zone. If we are averse to being in that twilight zone, then we're going to be in a problem. Okay? And if we're going to, often what we do is we see things around ourselves and different aspects of Buddhism which we don't like, or the monastery, whatever, and we criticize things. And of course it's very often coming from our own sense of inadequacy, our own sense of realization that within ourselves we don't measure up to our own ideal which we're cherishing. And so we also hold those around us, people around us, places and things and so on, we hold them accountable to our own unrealistic expectations. And so we're going to criticize them if they don't meet up with our unrealistic expectations. Okay? So this is a kind of dynamic which can happen, and which we all have to be wary of to notice the dynamic of it. and to not buy into it. And the way to do that, like the deep way to do that, is an acceptance of our own suffering and our own sadness. And to be able to simply feel that sadness and melancholy. You know, just like if you're sitting in the room and you can, if you feel like that very, very soft rain outside at night time, and you can just sort of almost hear it, and the rain falling down very gently onto the leaves outside. It's not like a thunderstorm, it's not anything dramatic. It's just a very kind of gentle sprinkling. And it has quite a soothing, melancholy feel to it. And so if you look in the heart, then you see it's like the same, similar kind of feel to that. This feeling of very gentle weeping that's going on there. Not something that you necessarily want to analyze or explain. It's difficult to difficult to talk about it or understand or explain it without, in some sense, kind of trivializing the experience. So this isn't what I'm talking about. Is not, I'm not talking about a kind of emotional narcissism. I'm not talking about like saying if I feel it, therefore it's real and it's me. Okay. This also is not Buddhist, not the Buddhist approach to things. Feelings are just feelings, they're also just conditioned, they come and they go, we shouldn't give them too much importance. But we give them their, we give them the importance that they're due. And they're to be felt, feelings are to be felt, so we experience them, we feel them. And remind ourselves that feeling of sadness and melancholy sometimes is very seductive. You know, it's like sad songs. You know, we love to listen to a sad song, or you know, makes us sort of evokes that kind of feeling response. Somehow it feels good to be sad. There's something peaceful about it. And in some way there's also like a sense of childishness about it. Like it's just an ability to feel things without intellectualizing them, without you know, having a theory or thinking about them or whatever, but just like kids who just, they just feel their feelings. And so we can just try just doing that, just to feel it in the innocence of it, the innocence of that feeling of sadness as it just as it just passes through and comes for a while and then leaves. So as we do this and we learn to understand those feelings, then we become more, first of all we become more accepting of our own emotions, realizing that You know, there's no point in judging and favoring and opposing and all of these kinds of things. So they're just part of us, they're part of what it means to be human, that's all. It's not such a big deal, really. And we also become more accepting of others and more sensitive to others, to be able to listen for where they're at and to not be speaking or acting in a way that's going to bring harm and pain to others. Because we see how much that hurts within ourselves. But this also, by doing this also tends to, I think, or I hope, would tend to heal that rift between the ideal and the actual. To realize that when we ordain as bhikkhus or bhikkhunis, samaneras, or if we just come to practice in the monastery for a while, then that is a mixture of things. We bring to that we bring to that the full complexity of who we are and who we have been and who we want to be. We have a pure motive to ordain, and yet that purity isn't all that we bring into the monastery. We bring a whole mixture of pure and impure motives, ideas, emotions, thoughts, and blah blah blah. And so we need to learn to appreciate that and to try to work with that as best as we can, and not just simply pretend that somehow we've become pure because we've shaven our heads or we've come into the monastery or because we've put on the robe and so on and so forth. As we were reading in one of the suttas a little while ago, that's not merely because of the shaving the head and putting on the robe that one becomes a true samana. And so if we appreciate the wholeness of that, we realize that that's actually, it's not a problem. It's actually the thing itself. The fact that we have our dark side, that we have our shadow side, that we have, you know, the defilements. That's why we undertake the holy life. If we didn't have them, we wouldn't have to. We just go and be arahants and go and lie on the beach in Byron Bay and smoke a joint and play the guitar and just be enlightened up there and go surfing. It's great. Why bother with a monastery? So it's because we have that whole complexity and richness of us. This is what makes the practice practice. It's what makes the holy life actually something worth living. And even though sometimes we might despair, we look at the depth of our own defilements. We might look, we've been practicing for many years, maybe we see that certain things we just can't overcome. They just reappear again and again and again. We can look into our history and think, oh my God, I was doing this when I was 14, you know? The same defilements I can see in my own mind when I was 7 years old. Same defilements I saw when I was 20 years old. And I've been practicing all these years and the same things are there. And so you can get very frustrated, you get very depressed about it. But you can also see that there are certain things that you had in those times that you don't have now. Certain areas where the practice has worked and has improved. Maybe it's just old age. Maybe it's got nothing to do with practice. Maybe it's just you get older and you get a bit more calm. I don't know. And so there's a sense in which the bigger our defilements, actually the grander our practice is. And actually that becomes maybe more difficult, maybe longer, but actually in some senses more useful. That's why, for example, Ajahn Chah was able to be such a great Dhamma teacher, because he did have very strong defilements. And because of his diligence and perseverance, he managed to overcome them. And so that meant he could have a strong empathy and understanding of other people's practices, other people's problems in their practice. Could be very helpful for them. Other people who are more naturally pure and don't have to overcome so many difficulties, then maybe they're not going to be so useful for others. So we shouldn't despair at never despair at the quantity of our defilements. It is, in fact, the size of our defilements is, it's just the tip of the iceberg. If we were to really see the full tenacity of our own defilements, like the Buddha reflecting and thinking, oh my God, why am I going to teach anybody? What's this Dhamma? It's just, nobody's going to understand this. Once he really understood the strength of the defilements. So if we were to really see it, we'd probably be scared off. But of course, the only... the thing that we also don't understand, we also underestimate, is the power of the practice and the power of the path. And this is also something which is, we can only see the tip of the iceberg. We can only have a very shallow grasp of what these things are. Until we've learned to experience them more deeply. So this is my little talk for you this evening on how it's okay to be sad. So I offer this to you for your reflection. And does anyone have any comments or questions?